Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When it comes to food and eating, Michael Pollan has made a big name for himself and a big issue of American eating habits. His best-selling books, The Omnivore's Dilemma and In Defense of Food, have changed the national conversation around our diets and the food industry. But recession, empty pockets, and sharp marketing have kept fast food sales going strong. Now, Pollan's out with a manual for better eating. Simple rules, such as, if it's not food if it arrived through the window of your car. This hour On Point, what we eat now and how we could eat better with Michael Pollan. You can join the conversation. Has Michael Pollan been your food guru? How's it going? Have you tried and failed to change your eating habits? Have you succeeded? And why is it so hard to turn the American diet? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Berkeley, California, is author Michael Pollan, author of The Omnivore's Dilemma, The Botany of Desire, and In Defense of Food, an Eater's Manifesto. He's out with a new book, a compact little guide to eating called Food Rules, an Eater's Manual. Michael Pollan, welcome.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be here. Good to be back.
It's good to have you, and good to have you back. It's also recession time, and the fast food outlets that you've been making a lot of for a long time are pushing just as hard as they can. Listen to this one, Michael. You must have heard it. Subway's $5 foot-long campaign. These are $5 sandwiches piled with a lot of food you might not approve of. $3.8 billion in sales generated nationwide. Here's a sample of their catchy commercial.
To say thanks for making Subway footlongs famous, get any piled high regular footlong for just $5. $5 footlongs. Hurry, a celebration this great won't last long.
Subway's $5 footlong, and it's a celebration, Michael Pollan, of a whole lot of food I'm not sure you would put your stamp of approval on.
Oh, you know, I can beat that. Have you seen the Jack in the Box ads?
No, what have they got now?
They have a new jumbo meal. You can get a burger, french fries, soda, and two meat tacos for $3.49.
Oh, geez, someone's got
Can't beat that.
Double quarter pounder with cheese for 99 cents or something like that. I've heard out there. I mean, what's happening to all your work against this tide of, recession-driven fast food bargains, Michael?
Well, I think the aggressive marketing doesn't necessarily mean that it's working. I mean, they're out there marketing and pushing it, and there's no
question.
And
selling it, $3.8 billion of those $5 footlongs.
Some of the fast food companies are doing very well in the recession, some less well. But there's some other more positive trends, I think. Mm-hmm. If you go to the supermarket chains and ask them what's selling, they will tell you ingredients are selling better than they have been. The bulk food bins at Whole Foods are selling better than they have been. People are also cooking. People are trading down in many ways. And for some people, that means going from a white tablecloth restaurant to McDonald's or Subway. And for other people, that means staying home and cooking more. So there's, you know, it's a very mixed bag. There's some very positive trends and negative trends. The farmers markets are still thriving. Even though people have less money to spend. Some organic categories are down, some are up. But it is, you know, no question. It's the problem begins with the fact that to eat healthily in this country costs more than to eat badly. And naturally, when people feel under a lot of financial stress, their choices are going to be constrained.
You've got 60 or 70 rules in your food rules eater's manual.
64 to be exact.
64. Number 44, exactly that one. I don't know if everybody can afford it. You tell us, rule number 44 from Michael Pollan, pay more, eat less.
Well, what I'm suggesting is it's very hard for some people to pay less. There's no question.
To pay more, I guess you mean.
To pay more. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. But what I'm suggesting is to pay a little bit more attention to quality than quantity. I mean, yeah, you can get all that food from Jack in the Box for $3.49. But we know what it is. We've recently learned a lot about what it is. In fact, there was a very interesting expose about the additive to fast food hamburgers, an additive that's in 80% of the preformed hamburger patties at fast food outlets and in
what
supermarkets.
Is it?
Well, they take the worst scraps from the meat industry, stuff that used to be turned into cat food and dog food, and they figured out a way to treat it with ammonia, high levels of ammonia, to kill the salmonella and listeria and E. coli in it. And then they take that ammoniated sludge. It's actually been called pink slime by a USDA staffer, and they add that because they can save a couple pennies by using that to cut the hamburgers. It looks like cottage cheese, and it smells like window cleaner. and this is what allows them to sell that food that cheap. It's a shame people sometimes can't afford better food than that. But it's very important that we all know what we're eating when we're eating this kind of cheap food.
You've got a lot of rules to help get around it. Pink slime, not at the top of your list. you tell us right at the top that
avoid pink slime.
Avoid
would be
pink slime.
Rule number 65.
Not number one. And you know, throughout this conversation, I can't help but bear in mind that as we talk about Americans and their eating habits and their obesity very often and what they're up against in health terms from those high fat diets, we've got Haiti going on right now with people without water, without food. The contrast is sharp and hard. And for all of our listeners who may also have that thought, at our website, onpointradio.org, there is a full list of groups working in Haiti right now to get food in there. But there's a big issue in this country as well, and it has to do with this country's health and this country's budgets going forward, Michael. I mean, you said this is directly related to the whole big health care debate that's been raging for the last year.
Without question. Look, the more we look at the question, cheap food is very expensive, and one of the biggest prices of cheap food is healthcare. When I was a boy back in 1960, we were paying about 18% of our income for food and only 5% of our income, national income, for healthcare. Those numbers have flopped. Today, we're only spending 9.5% of our income on food, and we're spending 17% of national income on healthcare. So the less you spend on food, the more you spend on healthcare. And when we look at these, you know, astounding numbers in the healthcare debate, $2.3 trillion spent to treat us. Well, look, 3/4 of that amount is going to treat what the CDC calls preventable chronic diseases. Mm. Now, those are not all food-related. There's smoking in there and alcoholism and things like that. But a very high percentage are, upwards of $500 billion, are going to treat diet-related conditions. So that this diet takes an enormous toll on our budget. And we are not going to get a handle on the healthcare crisis, really, until we take a good hard look at the American diet and make it easier for people with whatever their budget to eat healthier.
So begin to take us into some of your rules that might help people do that. You say right at the beginning of the book, eating in our time has gotten complicated. Why?
Well, because we have this debate going on at any given time about what nutrients are good and what nutrients are bad. And the identity of the good guys and the bad guys is constantly shifting based on the latest nutritional study, diet trend, whatever it is. I mean, we all, you know, your audience is old enough to remember the switch from worrying about fat to worrying about carbs, mm-hmm. which happened kind of overnight in the year 2002. Is fiber, you know, the be-all and end-all? Well, we thought so for a while, and we ate a lot of oat bran, and then we discovered, well, maybe fiber isn't that important. Antioxidants now are the key thing. I mean, every cereal on the cereal aisle has antioxidants to improve your immunity. We sell food based on health claims, but it turns out that most of those health claims have very little grounding in science. Scientists know less than you would think about nutrition and health. We still don't know what happens to your body when you sip a soda. We don't know why you've got brain cells in your stomach. We don't really know what's going on deep in the soul of a carrot to make it such a healthy food. Yet we act as though we do. We all carry around all this biochemistry from day to day and feel we need to know what an antioxidant is or omega-3 fatty acids in order to eat well. And my contention is we don't. The scientists need these terms. They need to focus on nutrients. But we need to focus on foods. That's what we can recognize, and that's what we know works, real food. The industry loves this whole conversation about science because it allows them to sell food to us in novel new ways. They can take a cereal like Cocoa Krispies or Fruit Loops that is a product that's over 40% sugar by weight and pretend it's medicine. And suggest to parents that it will help with swine flu or that it will improve their kids' focus in school.
Because it has vitamins, it has fiber, it has some particular item in addition to all that sugar.
Yeah, and take the focus off the sugar and the chocolate. And so it's a kind of false consciousness that we all get swept up in because nobody really wants to talk about how much we eat. We'd much prefer to talk about what we're eating. And the industry, of course, you know, the worst thing that could happen to them is if we actually ate less. and they will use health claims and bogus science to encourage us to eat more. What happens is when you demonize one nutrient, as we have demonized fat, say, in our food conversations, you're automatically giving a free pass to another nutrient, whatever nutrient you put in your no-fat product or low-fat product. So that the more we worried about fat, the more carbs we ate. And now the more carbs we worry about, the more protein we ate. There's always something to eat more of, and the industry loves to focus on that.
Michael Pollan.
But it really does distract us.
Boiling it down to some simple rules here on the cereal front, rule number 36, don't eat breakfast cereals that change the color of the milk. That goes to your sugar cereal. One, here's number 21. It's not food if it's called by the same name in every language. Think Big Mac, Cheetos, or Pringles. Now, what? Why?
Well, these are, you know, highly processed.
Mm-hmm.
These are highly processed foods. Look, my beef is really with highly processed food, food that's been refined sugars, refined flours, and that you can avoid those. You know, real food doesn't change the color of the milk. And I don't even want you to have to worry about ingredient labels. You know which which cereals change the color of the milk.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about what to eat and the choices we make with food guru Michael Pollan. He's boiled down an awful lot of advice that he's given over the years into a compact little book called Food Rules and Eater's Manual. It's got 64 rules, and we'll dive into more of them. He joins us from Berkeley, California. Michael, let's get some listeners in here. Karen in Lexington, Massachusetts, you're on the air with Michael Pollan.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Michael. I am a restaurant owner, and I'm actually currently on a catering job bringing brown rice and a garlic lentil stir fry with veggies and a salad and locally sourced oat cakes and apple butter to a farming conference.
Hey, you're Pollan-esque.
Sounds delicious.
My concern is that I have specifically opened a restaurant. I've been doing this for 6 years. I had a small fast casual restaurant, which sort of competed in the fast food market. I recently opened a full service mid-priced restaurant in Lexington, Mass. To specifically target that mid-priced food, because my feeling is we sort of went to rockstar chefs can only feed us, and then we let every other price point in our food in outside of the home go to corporate America.
So I think you're right.
I'm trying to come in at a mid-price point where families can come in, high schoolers can, you know, it opens the door to a greater diversity economically. The challenge is, and I think Dr. Kessler in his book, The End of Overeating, points this out, the mid-price point, they brought in food scientists to literally change the brain chemistry of the eaters. They layered fat, sugar, and salt to create this feedback loop that becomes almost addictive, which, of course, speaks to the obesity epidemic we're up against. And I just want to shout out to the people, you know, there are restaurant owners trying to do something differently, but you need to respond to what we're offering, too. We have every protein option you'd like. We aren't exclusively vegetarian or vegan, although we serve tofu, tempeh, free-range, you know, ground beef burgers. I had people that wouldn't come back to the restaurant because we didn't have French fries.
Yeah,
there's
what you're up against, but you've got Michael Pollan's beat on it, and you're trying. Michael, does it work? Will Americans buy it, you know, in the main?
Some will, some won't. Look, the fast food diet is very seductive. It's been, as Karen was suggesting, it's been engineered to be very appealing to us by pressing our buttons with salt, fat, and sugar. Those happen to be very cheap ingredients, the cheapest in the marketplace, and we respond to them, very well. And to eat in a different way, some people have to get used to a different threshold of salt, a different threshold of sugar, and some people simply won't do it. And, I'm not trying to reach everybody. I'm just trying to reach people who want to change and show them the virtues of changing. I mean, that they will be healthier and happier and many good things will follow. And of course, there'll be an enormous boon to the environment. We haven't talked about the land very much, but the cheap food economy takes a terrific toll on the land, too. And that is a concern for some people, and it's not a concern for everybody. But I just want also people who are eating junk food to at least be conscious of what they're doing. I mean, my goal as a writer is to get people to be thoughtful and knowledgeable about their eating choices, not to necessarily eat one diet. There is no ideal diet. There really isn't. I mean, one of the lessons of studying nutritional sciences, it's amazing how many different kinds of foods around the world people have been healthy on. You know, you've got, the Inuit in Greenland who eat a diet that's about 75% fat in the form of seal blubber.
Right.
They have no heart disease.
Right.
They have no type 2 diabetes.
Or the Maasai in Africa, blood, meat, and milk.
Yeah, they're also some of the healthiest people on Earth, a very high-protein diet. And then you've got the Native Americans in Central America who eat basically corn and beans, also very, very healthy. So don't let anyone tell you there is one ideal diet. What we do know is that the diet most of us are eating, given, this incredible range of possible things we could eat, we seem to have settled on the one diet that reliably makes us sick.
How did that happen? I'm looking at the news today that the founder of Taco Bell, Glenn W. Bell, died yesterday. He was 86 years old. Way back in 1951, he had the idea to sell crispy shell tacos from a window in his hamburger stand. And, then he sold it to PepsiCo. Now there's 5,600 Taco Bell restaurants around the world. They sell 2 billion tacos and 1 billion burritos every year. Now, this guy just had a little hamburger stand. He didn't set out to corrupt the diet of the Western world, but yet it took over. How? Why?
Well, because it's cheap and it's convenient. And cooking is many people regard as a burden. And it also, this food is, as I suggested, is engineered to be very attractive. Look, cheap food is always popular. And the government loves cheap food. And they do their best to engineer a cheap food supply. They've been doing this since the French Revolution, when the dangers of expensive food became, vividly clear to the French monarchy. So you have a lot of forces working together to make food cheap, even if it isn't nutritious. And I think that really is our problem. So it does take more work. I mean, you either have to invest some more money or some more time to eat in a healthy way. But it's doable if you're willing to cook, I think. That really is so key, that you can eat really, really well on a budget if you're willing to cook.
Rule number 63, just simply cook. C-O-O-K,
yeah.
Period. But that is not something that fits into a lot of Americans' eating patterns these days. I mean, Americans are eating out more and more. In fact, you're right, they're being encouraged to leave the cooking to corporate America.
Corporations, sure. Well, of course, the corporations want to cook for us. They want to do everything for us. They want to, they would chew for us and swallow for us if they could figure out a way to do it. I mean, their goal in life is to take simple things we used to do for ourselves and convince us we can't do them for ourselves, and only corporations can do that. That's their business model. We need, though, to take back control of our diet, and I think even some control of the production of our food by gardening, which is just when we're talking about budget, that's something we really need to address. If you're willing to put $70 into a home vegetable garden, you will get this year $600 worth of fresh produce, organic, local, fresh, as tasty as anything you can buy. So there are ways around the recession. And in fact, people are planting gardens. There's another trend to go with your the success of Subway.
Mm-hmm.
Home gardening is up 40%.
Bravo.
And seeds are selling out all over the country. If you want to plant a garden, order your seeds right now, because a lot of them are going to run out this year.
You heard it here first. Let's go to our callers. A lot of them are lined up for you, Michael. Patricia in Columbus, Ohio. Patricia, you're on the air.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Michael, my angle, I'm kind of a new convert to this whole way of life and enjoying it, and my angle is more from an animal welfare perspective. I mean, it's obviously it plays into nutrition and the environment, but I'm kind of coming at it from an animal welfare perspective, and I'm familiar with at least three, if not four, and I know Whole Foods is coming out with its own humane brand to be placed actually on the foods within the supermarkets. And I'm calling from Columbus, and I'm not seeing much of this make its way into the supermarket. I'm wondering if you can speak to, you're obviously in a more progressive area than I am, as far as this movement's concerned, and if you're seeing some of these humane food labels making their way into the supermarket, something that the actual consumer can look to guide their consuming practices.
Thanks, Patricia.
Yeah, it's a good question. A lot of people share your concern about factory farming. I mean, people have had an opportunity in the last year or two to learn a lot about how their meat is produced. And many people recoil in horror to see these images and to learn about the process, because it is really a miserable process. And yet people want to eat meat, and they want to do it in as responsible a way as possible. The challenge is knowing how your meat was produced. And labels are a substitute for actually being able to ask questions directly or visit the farms where the animals come from, or the CAFOs, as they're called, concentrated animal feeding operations. And there are a couple labels that are out there. The Humane Society has one that I'm starting to see pop up around eggs and things like that especially. And then Whole Foods, as you said, is working on their own label. And I think you're going to see a lot more of that. I mean, there is a growing movement of what's called compassionate carnivorism. And obviously, you need to be able to give the consumer the information. I also think, though, you're going to see a move in this direction from some of the large food companies. They're under enormous pressure to ban things like sow crates, keeping female pigs in confinement their entire lives in tiny little cages, or chickens that live, jammed together in little cages their whole lives, laying hens, not broiler chickens. And so some of the big companies are close, I think, to abandoning those practices. And, you know, if they all abandon them, they're not at a competitive disadvantage over price. And they're learning that there are other ways to grow food. There are also some brands that, you know, Chipotle sources their meat very carefully, and their pork is sustainable and humane. And you can go in there and they'll tell you about how they do it.
Is there a connection, Michael, between animal or livestock quality of life and human quality of diet in your book?
Well, yes, there is. And the fact is that when we grow animals in large confinement operations and feed them the most economical but perhaps not most natural diet, such as when we feed cattle corn when they should be getting grass, it does take a toll on the quality of the food. There is very good research to suggest that grass-fed beef, for example, has higher levels of healthy fats like omega-3 and lower levels of unhealthy fats like saturated fat, and that and also animals that are stressed this is going to sound weird, they don't taste as good as animals that lead good lives and are slaughtered in a humane way. Stress leads to very, you know, off flavors in beef and pork, and off textures in pork. So that there is, you know, one of the nice things about paying attention to these issues is that the most ethical way of growing the food and the most environmental way of growing the food and the tastiest way of growing the food are the same. The only trade-off is price. So you don't have to make a choice between your environmental or ethical values and the deliciousness of a meal. They tend to follow one another.
Rule number 23, treat meat as a flavoring or special occasion food. And 27, eat animals that have themselves eaten well. Let's get a call from Naomi in Boston. Hi, Naomi. You're on the air with Michael Pollan.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Michael. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
So there's one word that comes to mind. It's consistency, right? McDonald's does it your way every time you go. And so I think, you know, to take back the, pardon my word, but the sexiness of eating what, you know, we grow, what's natural, what's imperfect. So I'm all for that.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, I think that, you know, look, I give a lot of credit to industrial agriculture, not only for making food incredibly cheap, but for making it consistent. And there are a lot of people who are comforted by the idea that they can walk into a McDonald's anywhere in the country and the French fries will be exactly the same. But when you look at how you make a French fry look as long and golden, as blemish-free as that McDonald's French fry, you may not want it so much. You know those little brown spots you sometimes get in potatoes and French fries? Well, McDonald's won't accept those. It's a totally harmless cosmetic defect. However, to avoid it, you need to spray your potatoes with some of the most toxic chemicals we have in our arsenal, pesticides like Monitor, that are such serious neurotoxins that the farmers will not go into the field for 5 days after they've sprayed it.
Wow.
Because of the fear of brain damage. They'll even let, you know, if they lose an irrigation pivot, they'll let it go rather than try to fix it, all to prevent those little brown spots from discomforting you at McDonald's. So as consumers, we have a responsibility, too, to understand that, okay, a couple brown spots is really worth it if the farmers don't have to be exposed to this horrible neurotoxin.
Mm-hmm. Naomi, Michael writes, don't ingest foods made in places where everyone is required to wear a surgical cap. And on the funkier side of that, eat only foods that will eventually rot, and eat some foods that have been pre-digested by bacteria or fungi, not something I've heard Michael in a McDonald's at. Pre-digested.
Well, yeah, it's not the most felicitous phrase, but basically I'm talking about foods that have been fermented and things like yogurt. It turns out that there's a lot of benefit. You know, all cultures
have kimchi, soy sauce, sourdough
exactly.
bread even. Why?
Yeah, well, because these very often these bacteria and fungi transform the food in a way that adds nutrients and makes it more digestible. So that there is they introduce bacteria, very beneficial bacteria, into the gut. And there is some good research now that probiotics help with things like immunity. And guess what? These things taste good. You know, one of my, you know, happiest discoveries is learning how much wisdom is contained in traditional foodways, and that doing things like preserving milk by turning it into yogurt, preserving cabbage by turning it into sauerkraut, all these kind of things that people have done turned out to have a medical logic that nobody was aware of. But through trial and error, cuisines really, you know, we have to realize that those are repositories of a kind of wisdom that science hasn't matched yet. And we have food science on the other side, you know, which sometimes is good at fortifying our foods with missing nutrients, usually ones that have been removed in processing. Mm. But that there's, you know, the science sometimes comes late. There was a recent study that showed that if you consume your tomatoes with olive oil, it's better for you because it makes the lycopene in the tomatoes, a powerful antioxidant, more available, more because it's soluble in oil.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Italian grandmas have known this for a very long time, and they didn't need science to tell them it's a very good idea to eat olive oil with tomatoes.
You've got a lot of props for the grandmothers in here and the great-grandmothers in the old country. Rule 41, eat more like the French or the Japanese or the Italians or the Greeks. In effect, you're saying eat more like almost like your
any
great-grandparents
tradition,
no matter where they came from.
Any tradition you like. I mean, look, if a diet has survived as long as these diets have survived, it means that they worked, that they kept people healthy, and that, you know, those combinations, those habits, you know, on balance, will be better for you than a fast food diet. And, you know, as I say, our genius as a civilization has been to invent a diet that makes us unhealthy. It is very profitable, but it is not good for us.
Better pay the grocer than the doctor is a grandma-sounding piece of advice you've got in here.
Well, that goes back to this idea that, you know, to invest a little bit more money in food pays big dividends, and that it might seem like a sacrifice, but you will save in other places. A study just came out in the British Journal of Psychiatry correlating fast food eating with depression. And because of the food has lots of calories in it and lots of refined carbohydrates, which give you kind of a boost, but then you crash. And, you know, I don't know if this is an association or a cause and effect, but the fact is people on a heavy fast food diet are more depressed than people who eat real food.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about what to eat and the choices we make with food guru Michael Pollan. His new book is Food Rules, an Eater's Manual. 64 rules kind of extracted from his earlier big books that he says will put you on a road to better health and a better diet. Michael Pollan joins us from Berkeley, California. And Michael, just a little bit here from speaking of food rules and diets and Taco Bell. This was their campaign in December. A new commercial launched suggesting, it seemed, that their low-calorie Fresco menu might be used as a potential diet aid. This is Taco Bell. Ad features a woman named Christine Doherty who claims to have lost weight in part by choosing food off Taco Bell's Fresco menu.
I lost 54 pounds by reducing my daily calories and replacing my usual fast food with Taco Bell's drive-through diet. That's 7 delicious items, all under 9 grams of fat. When I decided to trim down, I knew I had to be realistic with myself. I didn't want to cut out my fast food, so I started choosing Fresco items from the drive-through diet menu. These results aren't typical, but for me, they're fantastic.
54 pounds, she said you lost, Michael, replacing her usual fast food with the Taco Bell's drive-through diet. How about it, Michael? I didn't find it in your book.
These results aren't typical, I think she said.
Yes, I think so.
I think that's a wonderful ad. I think it's probably possible. And you can get salads at McDonald's. So watch out, though. The salads at McDonald's have more fat than a, if you use the dressing, than a Big Mac. Well, that's a kind of, audacious ad, I must say.
I didn't want to cut out my fast food, so I started.
God forbid. These are big sacrifices we're asking people to make. I understand.
Oh, boy, let's get a call. Brian in Lynchburg, Virginia. Brian, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a big fan of Mr. Pollan and his books. And my question is, I really appreciate the insight Mr. Pollan's given a lot of folks with his books. One thing that comes to mind is corn policy in this country and the farm bill and how much corn is subsidized and therefore how much food really contains corn that we don't realize. But given the fact that the Iowa caucuses always come first and therefore politicians perhaps not curiously love corn, that doesn't seem like the easiest food policy element to change. So my question for Mr. Pollan is, what are some really politically palatable things that you think we could really change as a matter of policy that can both realistically happen and can have a real impact on our diet and how we eat and our health?
Great question,
well,
Brian.
I think it's a terrific question. And you're right in pointing to our agricultural policies as at the root of these problems. One of the reasons that fast food is so inexpensive is that we subsidize it. And the way we subsidize it is by subsidizing things like corn and soy. These are the building blocks of that fast food diet, and they're dirt cheap. Farmers can sell them at below the cost of production because the government will make up the difference. And the corn and the soy becomes the feedlot meat. It's the feed for the animals. And then it gets processed into all the kind of the obscure ingredients on the side label of the, the Twinkies pack. So how do you change that? Well, I think you begin by saying to the farmers, look, we don't want to take away your subsidies. You're going to get as much money as you're getting now, but we're going to ask you to do something else for that money. You did what we asked you to, which was to produce lots of cheap calories. As it turned out, you did too good a job, and we have too many cheap, unhealthy calories. Now we want you to help us solve our national problems again. Our national problems are our public health disaster, that is the American diet, and climate change and the environmental crisis. And the farmers hold the key to both problems, to the solutions to both problems. So you pay farmers, instead of growing corn and soy by the bushel, you pay them for diversifying their crops. You allow them, the farmers who want to get off of the corn and soy trap and grow real vegetables. Do you know right now if a farmer receiving subsidies in the Midwest decides he wants to plant tomatoes, or she decides she wants to do squash and get in on this whole local food scene, they're fined by the government. They're not permitted to do that because they're corn. They're exclusively corn and bean farmers in the eyes of the government. So we're getting in the way of farmers who want to innovate and plant different things. I think we can reward farmers for taking some of that land out of crops and putting it into perennials, especially the hilliest, most erosion-prone land. And instead of growing animal feed, put animals back on the grass. This would be an enormous boon to our health and to the health of the land to have more perennial pastures in the Midwest, especially along the Mississippi.
But do you see the leverage out there to make that happen, Michael?
Well, the problem is we need to take control of our farm policy, which right now is dominated by the big food processors. Make no mistake, this system does not benefit our farmers. It benefits the buyers of cheap agricultural commodities. I'm talking about Coca-Cola and McDonald's and all the corporations that really like having cheap raw ingredients. And right now, the agricultural committees respond to those interests and those political contributions. To the extent we make food a political issue, to the extent that eaters decide they want to say in our farm policies and start writing their legislators when the farm bill comes around or the child school lunch reauthorization program, which is just about to come around now, they will realize that this is not an easy vote. You can't just give this vote away to agribusiness. And that's when you'll see some change.
It's been given away many a time. Let's get a call from Cheyenne, Wyoming. Cheyenne, Lynn, you're on the air.
Yes. My question is, how do you eliminate sweets? I used to do it with fruits, but I no longer can do that because fruits and vegetables are grown so large and processed so much, even the raw ones, that they have no flavor anymore.
So you've got a sweet tooth and you need to know how to satisfy it under Michael's rules.
Right.
Well, let's try. Eat sweet foods as you find them in nature is one of your rules, Michael. But Lynn's not happy with what she's finding in nature as delivered.
Well, can I suggest, I don't know where you live, but going to the farmer's market, the quality of fruit there, I realize it's for a limited season in certain parts of the country. You can't beat that stuff. That stuff has not been grown just to be pretty. It's grown to have flavor. And so you have to look harder. I agree. There is a lot of tasteless produce in the market right now, and especially this time of year. But the farmers markets have really good food. And also, you know, dried fruit is a lot sweeter than fresh fruit very often.
Lynn's in Cheyenne, Wyoming. It's a little cold there for farmers markets this time of year, no?
I have to say, if you're looking for a sweet hit, try the dried fruit.
Dried fruit and all the junk food you write, eat all the junk food you want as long as you cook it yourself. Now, what do you mean exactly by that?
Well, you know, I realize a big part of the trouble we got into with food is that it became too easy for us, both in terms of effort and price, to eat foods that historically have been special. Fried chicken was not something everybody made every day. Mm. It was something you made when you had, a lot of people coming over because it was a lot of work and it made a huge mess. And same with cakes. You didn't make them every day because they were just too much work.
Mm-hmm.
And French fries is a great example. I love French fries. And they've become so cheap and ubiquitous, and it takes no effort to eat them.
Them at home with the oil splattering and all the rest, you might think twice.
Exactly, and cutting the potatoes and cleaning the potatoes and frying the potatoes and what do you do with the fat and cleaning up the kitchen? You'll only have them every couple weeks, which is probably about right. And you know what? They'll be so much better than the ones you can buy at fast food outlet. So, you know, if we put these special occasion foods back in their place, you know, enjoy them, but on special occasions, treat treats as treats is another rule in the book, we'll be better off. And, you know, it's not like we have to deprive ourselves of these things. And, you know, because I like this kind of stuff as much as the next person.
Lynn and Cheyenne, whip that cake up for yourself, but take your time and eat it slowly, I guess, and not too often. Matt in Gardner, Massachusetts. Matt, you're on the air with Michael Pollan.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Well,
pretty good, thanks.
Thank you. I was just commenting about a earlier question. You mentioned what would be the hardest part about switching to a more natural diet. And for me, coming from Central Mass, there really isn't a whole local food group. There really isn't good natural mom-and-pop restaurants. There's a lot of chains, a lot of food really just eaten for emotional impact over nutritional value. And moving away from home for a while, going out to Amherst, where there's a little bit more of the whole mom-and-pop stores, good food. I mean, you get quality food, and I come back with those ideas. And honestly, I'm more or less shunned by family and friends who feel if it tastes good, it's good. You know, they want to go to Olive Garden, a chain, a place like that. And honestly, they're just going there for the emotional impact of it, the idea of going there is fun. When you get there, it's presented in a fun way, and it's not necessarily good for you. And that's kind of a little bit of clash I had.
So Matt, do they think you're kind of a bummer when you're not all fired up for that menu?
Oh, definitely, definitely. They think I'm a little crazy just for not liking that. What's wrong with this? You know, and I tell them I want to eat something else. You know, I want to go to a sushi place. I want to go to a raw, you know, vegetable place. And that's kind of almost disgusting to them. And I'm sure there's plenty of other small towns around the country who have similar stigmas and ideas as mine.
Yeah, Matt, let us pick it up. And Michael, if I may, there's another here from Facebook from Elena. It's similar. She says, what's the best way of raising awareness or subtly mentioning to family and friends about the benefits of buying from local food stores beyond just leading by example, kind of in the same vein?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think you do risk being early adapters of a new way of doing things. You risk the opprobrium of your friends. And, you know, the people who were annoyed by having smokers in their face all the time also were in the same boat 20 or 30 years ago. You know, if you were like, no, please don't smoke around me, or I'd rather go to the no smoking section of the restaurant, you too were greeted by that kind of criticism. And all I can say is, you know, I think history's on your side and you should stick to your guns.
What portion of the population, you know, geographically in this country now, do you feel has good options within, I don't know, a 15-minute drive or a half-hour walk might be better on your menu?
I mean, that's a good question, Tom. I really don't know. I mean, what I do know, though, is that healthier options are sprouting even in the most conventional supermarkets, that Walmart is selling organic food and selling local food, and they're having very, you know, very good success with it. And once Walmart gets in, you know, they will teach Americans and expose Americans to a whole lot of choices that they haven't had so far. Whole Foods is, you know, in more and more communities and offers some good choices. And farmers markets are sprouting up everywhere. The other thing is, too, if you don't see it in your everyday travels, go online. There's some excellent websites where you can actually hook up with farmers who are growing really good food, especially meat that you might not find anywhere else. And if you go to the Eat Well Guide, you can type in your zip code, and you'll be amazed at farmers doing good work, either, you know, growing really good quality eggs or pastured chickens, or with CSAs. A CSA is a subscription farm where mm-hmm. you pay the farmer a couple hundred dollars up front and you get a weekly box of produce. Mm-hmm. It's a very economical way to eat locally. So if you don't see it in the store, don't assume it's not in your community, because this movement is really popping up everywhere. And get online and look for it that way.
And if you do find yourself in the supermarket, rule number 12 of Michael's is shop the peripheries of the supermarket. Stay out of the middle where the processed food tends to lie. You say, Robin in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Robin, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm a Michael fan, Botany of Desire, one of my favorite all-time books. And I just want to say I cook for two teenagers every night, and they don't believe Taco Bell's food. You couldn't force feed them to eat it. You know? They don't. Well, it's a commodity. It's a filler. It could be dangerous. A lot of hands touch it, not just their mamas. You know, they don't believe it's food.
They're all done. They're moved on. Robin.
Well, you've brought them up well. You know, a lot of families feel that taking their kids to McDonald's, especially families without a lot of money, that it's a luxury. It's a cheap luxury you can afford. And it makes kids happy, you know, partly because they get bribed, by the way, with toys and things like mm-hmm. that. And but, you know, I think this is one of the really positive things Michelle Obama has been doing is kind of subtly suggesting that cooking real food for your kids, that's part of being a good parent. In the same way that Laura Bush, you know, got across this idea that reading to your kids mm-hmm. every night is part of being a good parent. And I think that, you know, this caller is onto something, that, you know, it's up to us as parents to you know, set the norms for our children. And we're up against incredible forces in that we, you know, as parents, our authority is undermined every day by the $30 billion in marketing messages that the food industry is sending to us. And the fact that, you know, they do market to children on their cartoon shows and so that they're getting these messages and they're getting them from other kids in schools. So it's very hard to go up against that tidal wave. But parents who do find that, you know, you can persuade your child that fast food is not such a great thing.
We've got so many callers we can't get to. Michael in Hartford, who says he's got a modest income and eats well from his garden and locally. Lydia, who wants to ask about the context for how and when we eat whatever it is that we eat. And you spend a lot of time on that. Do all your eating at a table, Rule 58. Try not to eat alone, Rule 58.
You know, this is a very important part of the picture. We think it's the content of our diet that determines everything, but it may well be our eating habits. Are we eating alone? You know, think about how automatically you eat in front of the television. You don't even know what you're eating or how much you're eating. When we eat with other people, we're reminded that food is really not just about fuel. It's not just a transaction between our body and certain chemicals. It's really about communion. And fast food teaches us to treat food as fuel. We need to get back to the kind of social mores that surrounded eating, because there's wisdom in those too.
Spend as much time enjoying the meal as it took to prepare it, or eat slowly. Are you winning? Is your perspective winning, Michael, on any kind of in a time frame that you expected or hoped for? Is the ship turning?
You know, I wouldn't say we're at a tipping point on the American diet yet. People have asked me that question, and I honestly don't think we are. But I do think more people are coming into this conversation about their own diets and the food system. You know, choices are difficult because of the environment we're in. People can preach personal responsibility, which is what the industry did with tobacco and what they're now doing with food. It's up to you. Don't let anyone tell you how to eat. But the fact is, we live in an environment, and the choices are set by institutions beyond our control, which is to say the government and these corporations. So it's a challenge, but people are doing it. People are moving.
Set your own table, baby. Take your time eating what's on it. Food Rules and Eater's Manual is Michael Pollan's potent little book right here. Michael, it's always great talking with you. Thank you very much for being with us today.
A pleasure, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Listeners, thank you for joining us as well. On Point is produced by Julie Jupp, Sam Gail Rosen, Ping Wong, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby, with help from Shirin Jafari. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.